You're listening to West Kent Radio. It's Martin Webber here, and I've been joined in the studio now by the leader of Tonbridge and Morning Borough Council, Matt Boughton. Well, we didn't see whether your microphone worked, Matt, but so say hello.
Hi, Martin. Good to be here.
I think we can all hear you loud and clear, which is great. Thanks so much for coming in.
That's all right. Good to see you.
So you've been in charge of the Tonbridge and Morning Borough Council for quite a while now, and you've learnt that it's going to be abolished.
Yes. So
what do you think about that?
It was a bit of a surprise when it came, but at the end of the day, the government has decided that it wishes to abolish all two-tier areas, so where you have a county council and a borough council, and create slightly larger councils where you've got just one authority, and then you have an elected mayor on top of that. The government's perfectly entitled to take that view. I think part of the problem for ours is that, effectively, they've put us on notice. And they've also said you've got to be in charge of your own destiny, or to a degree, at least. And that's involved quite a lot of work over the last few months.
Yes, so there's lots of debate now about what the new shape of Kent should look like. But just looking at this borough, I mean, it was formed back in the 1970s from a hodgepodge of urban districts and rural districts. You still occasionally see the odd sign around the place for that previous era. Do you think that this borough, I mean, with Tonbridge at the far sort of bottom left of it, really became a coherent area?
I've never tried to pretend that all of the parts of Tonbridge and Morlin necessarily relate to one another. I would say that we're a collection of communities rather than one singular community. We don't have a town of the size of a Tonbridge Wells or a Maidstone really as an anchor town within the borough. But by treating each place differently and by looking at the needs of different places and adapting your policies and what you do to those areas, actually I think you can do a pretty good job. And if you look at kind of all the reports that have been done independently into Tonbridge and Morling Borough Council over the last 50 years, you'll see that generally they've performed very highly in the council. And I say this prior to me taking over, and I hope this is very much the case now, has always been considered to be one of the best run councils in the country.
And I mean, there is an issue about whether there's a lot of debt around in some of these councils. What's the position of Tonbridge and Morling Borough Council's debt?
So we're one of the very few councils left in the country that doesn't have any debt at all. So I can turn around and say to everyone within Tonbridge and Morling that every single penny that you give to us is being spent on delivering what I hope are high quality facilities that you expect, not paying off debt or paying interest on debt. And it's something we're very proud of. It's become increasingly difficult to maintain that position. And if we were to have a lifespan that continued into the 2030s, I think it would be very, very challenging to keep that position. And we know that if we want to proceed with projects like replacing the Angel Centre in Tonbridge, that we probably will have to take on a little bit of debt. But at the end of the day, we still spend 57% of our revenue budget, or the equivalent thereof, on capital expenditure, i.e. we're able to do new things and build new things. And we've had a investor save policy for a long time around that. So actually we're making sure that we're not just making these improvements in the area, but we're doing so in a financially sustainable way. And that's one of the best things we've done to be able to keep ourselves out of debt.
So, of course, one of the issues is then if you merge all these councils together, communities that weren't profligate, if you like, in the past, didn't spend on projects or maybe elect the wrong people, their debts will be handed over to people in Tonbridge and Morling.
Yeah, and I think that's fundamentally unfair that we're going to have to take on the debts that other councils have incurred. I've made that point to government. Government aren't listening. They've got their finger in their ears when it comes to debt in Kent at the moment. And I think there's a real, real challenge that's going to face all of Kent through this reorganisation process as to how that's handled, because we know Kent County Council in particular, but also Medway Council, have got significant debts that go well over £1 billion. So we're all going to have to pay that off in some way, shape or form, regardless of whether we were responsible for accruing that in the first place.
Well, I suppose we are already liable for Kent County County Council debts, but what is the shape that you would prefer to come about? Because we had Reform UK moving its position. Previously, it backed the idea of splitting into North Kent, West Kent and East Kent. And then last week they came out and said, well, why not have one unitary authority for, you know, basically abolish everybody except themselves?
Well, exactly, and I called them out on that because it was quite clear to me what they were up to. They don't control any of the other 13 authorities, so it's easy for them to say, well, we'll abolish you lot and we'll just run it all ourselves. My position is quite clear on this, which is the number one most important thing is going to be to ensure that we don't break up the boroughs. And the reason for that is that we'll reduce the transition costs going forward. We know that the economic case for the new unitaries is marginal, and the government are wanting us to proceed with this anyway. So we're going to have to look at this very carefully in terms of how we ensure the new unitaries are financially fit for purpose. Now, to do that, you need to obviously treat the boroughs collectively, and the four authorities in West Kent, so they being Tunbridge and Morlin, Seven Oaks District Council, Tunbridge Wells Borough Council, and Maidstone Borough Council, we would meet the government's criteria working as a four. We're all happy to work with one another as part of a West Kent authority going forward, and we hope that our respective councillors will support that position, because we'd like to put across a good case to government as we look to do to get to the decision point in this process, which will come next year.
Now, some people would say that, well, you know, you've got Tunbridge and Morling at the moment, in some ways a bit distant from certain areas, one authority serving people, councillors who may represent one area, deciding things in the centre of Tunbridge, even though they live many, many miles away. Now, how's it going to change when the council, presumably that Maidstone is the biggest town of the lot, most likely that's where this new authority would be based. It seems quite a long way away from Tunbridge Wells.
So that problem that you described, Martin, with the current boroughs is simply a problem that is going to go on a greater scale when this happens. And I think ultimately it's going to be incumbent on whoever the people choose to elect them into the new authority as to whether they act in a way that respects all of the different places within the area. You're right, Maidstone would be the largest town, Tunbridge Wells would be the second largest town. But as we've proven at Tunbridge and Morlin over the year, you can deal with a borough that's got lots of different communities in and do what I like to consider is a good job at that. So it is possible, but you can't take your eye off the ball, and I hope whoever's elected to that authority will actually take that into account over its first few years.
I mean, there's give you a bit more of a counter-argument, because, I mean, obviously the government says this is a rationalisation of local authorities. It'll save money overall. It'll become more efficient, which, you know, as a Conservative, you're quite often keen on. And, you know, we're in a situation, as I understand it, the roads are run by Kent County Council and the pavements are run by the boroughs. Housing is run by the boroughs, and transport is run by the county. So people are generally confused. There's overlapping areas. Getting things done is difficult. I've spoke to the MP for Tunbridge Wells, Mike Martin, who said, yes, everything gets confused between these two authorities and it makes it more difficult for things to get done. So isn't there some advantage in every area knowing that there's one significant council that they have to deal with and elect?
I entirely agree, and if you're starting from scratch, absolutely, that's the system you would design. The issue is we're not starting from scratch, we're starting from a very complex position, as you've outlined. And the government, although it says it's abolishing the two-tier structure, well, actually it isn't, because what it's doing is creating not just an elected mayor of Kent, but something called a strategic authority, which effectively would act a bit like London Assembly does, but without anyone elected to it. They would either be appointees of the elected mayor or representatives of the component councils. And that strategic authority would take on an awful lot of what they call strategic services, so things like strategic planning and some of the strategic highways stuff too. So actually you've still got a two-tier structure under the new plans, and although it might not be as localised, the issues you describe, you will still have tension between the unitary authorities and the strategic authority, particularly if the elected representatives from different parties.
And that brings us on really to the idea of having a town council for the places that previously didn't have a town council, because they were also the centre of a borough, so both Tunbridge Wells and Tunbridge. There was a consultation on this, and if you look at the total number of people who could have voted, 9% of people were in support of setting up a brand new council just for the area of Tunbridge Town, 3% were against, and 88% didn't take part at all, which suggests that they weren't that interested.
And I think that says an awful lot, to be honest, Martin, and you've got to think of you're involved in this, why people decided they weren't interested in it. Look, for me, it's the thing with Tunbridge Town Council is that the reorganisation proposals essentially make the argument, which is that you need an authority of the size of a town like Tunbridge that would be able to deliver some local services, whether that's public toilets or allotments or any sort of street cleaning. And we'll have to see over the next few years what it does deliver, if indeed it is set up. But apathy won the day, then. I think it's quite clear to me. And should a Tunbridge Town Council be created? Because even though that's a result of the consultation, that isn't the end of the process. Then I think the new Tunbridge Town Council's very first task will be have to establish some credibility within the town. Because if it doesn't do that, then I think it'll find itself under an awful lot of pressure very early on.
So it's now up to the Borough Council to decide whether it should go forward or the idea should just be forgotten. So how will you be voting when it comes to the decision?
So it'll go to our meeting in October. And obviously, at this point, I need to talk to other councillors, see what their thoughts are on it. We only just got the results the other day, so it's very much hot off the press. Look, it's my anticipation that a Tunbridge Town Council will be created, and I've kind of had that anticipation for many months now, although the Borough Council is strictly neutral, because effectively it is running the process, which is why I haven't joined either campaign, and it's also why I've sort of made it quite clear to residents that it's their choice. Not ours, but look, more people who responded wanted it than didn't want it, and we've kind of got to respect that. I think just going back to the democratic argument that you make, Martin, it is a very good point, but the problem is, you see that at any election it's in itself. I was elected in an election in which 40% of people voted. So you could argue that the 60% who didn't vote in the election at all actually won the day there. Well, ultimately, you had the chance to vote, you didn't vote. And those people who did cast their ballot have elected myself to serve as councillor for the villagers that I represent. So if you have the choice to turn up and you don't turn up, can you complain about the result?
So how do you energise people more about what's going on in their community? We know the local newspapers are not as full of local information as they were. People rely on social media. And they get into a little niche, and they may or may not be in a niche of social media that actually informs them about their local area. But what's the answer?
Well, there's a couple of ways you can do it. Firstly, I think community activities are very important. I include community radio in that, and the work that West Kent Radio are doing. I think that's incredibly important about getting a very localised message out there. I also think that community groups, whether that's groups around sporting activities or simply social groups, are very much more important now. And we're seeing this in terms of how we're developing our plans for New Angel Centre in Tunbridge. There's lots of different community groups who've got an interest in that, and that's great, because actually it's given a common cause behind that. But it's a challenge that everyone faces. It's not just a problem that is unique to Tunbridge. It's not just a problem that's unique to West Kent at all. We've seen engagement on very local matters dwindle over recent years. Even at general election last year, the turnout wasn't as high as it has been in previous elections too. People are feeling just a bit fed up with a lot of stuff at the moment, and I think it's incumbent on everyone who cares about their area, however you wish to kind of articulate that care, to really try and energise people as much as you possibly can, and be honest about what you can and can't do, and also to share ideas and see if there's you can get a coalition of the willing behind that particular idea.
We've mentioned a few times the replacement for the Angel Centre. Why did that leisure centre need to be replaced?
Simply, it reached the end of its usable life, Martin. We'd end up in a really difficult position, because we'd have to invest an awful lot of money, multi-million pounds, in simply keeping the doors open and refurbishing it. Or we could invest a little bit more in actually building a state-of-the-art facility that's got modern facilities that people would expect, and we can also incorporate into a wider master plan of the area. And we thought actually that would be a really good opportunity to do that, because we could potentially get some enabling developments alongside it. So very excited about this project. I think it'd be great for the town.
And you want feedback from people about just what facilities they want there?
Yes, so we've launched a survey. It's open till the 24th of September on the Angel Centre specifically. We're asking about the facility mix. essentially what you would like inside the shell of the centre. We're looking to bring as much as we possibly can over from the Angel Centre at the moment. There's certainly no facility that will be excluded, but we want to include new things. For example, we'd like to include a children's soft play area, because there actually isn't that anywhere in Tunbridge, and I think there's a great market for that. I say that's someone with a one-year-old daughter, so I know sort of how challenging it is. So family-friendly facilities are what we're after, and we've got an opportunity to provide them. We just need to know what people want.
And will the area, do you think you'd be able to make better use of the river as a feature?
Yes, absolutely. We know that there are areas in Tunbridge in which the river really is to the fore, whether that's on River Walk or at the Town Lock area, or as it goes through Tunbridge Racecourse Sports Ground. But the area and the part of the river that sort of flows near the Angel Centre, it isn't capitalised in a positive way. We're looking to open that up as part of our master plan proposals and really look at some development that takes into account the setting of the river and the importance of actually utilising the river as the asset that it is. So we're hoping that by doing that, we can create development where people want to live, because there'll be some residential included within it too. But actually, it creates a really nice open frontage between where the Angel Centre will be located, which will be in the Farmers Market car park, and the High Street itself.
And so how much are you spending?
So the cost of the new Angel Centre, we're hoping that will be around about £19 million. So it's a loss of money. We've looked at, and we've got different ways of sourcing that money, but we knew that refurbishing it could cost probably £15 million, maybe more than that. So actually, as I say, we're spending a little bit more money, but I think the gain that we can make with a new centre would be significantly better than what we can get out of the Angel Centre, simply because there's new facilities that we can provide.
And will it be built to last? Because I can remember Tunbridge before Angel Centre was built, and to see the fact that it's already obsolete is suggests that it wasn't really built to last.
Yeah, and look, I wasn't around in the 1980s, so I don't know what the council were thinking about at the time. I wasn't even born. And I understand why they did it, firstly. I mean, obviously, at the time, that was absolutely right. But we're looking to have lots of flexible spaces in the new facility so that we can...
And will it be built to last? I mean, yes. We're not going to have to knock it down again in another 40 years.
No, absolutely. So we're looking at the most sustainable shell of the building that we can get, making sure it's completely energy efficient. Building regulations effectively insist on that anyway at the moment, but we'll go further than that in how sustainable it is. But as I say, within it, lots of flexible space, because the problem with the Angel Centre at the moment is the layout is incredibly inefficient. Lots of corridors leading off, which actually limit what you can do internally. And that's part of the reason why the refurbishment cost is so high. We wouldn't have that problem, or in 40 years' time, they wouldn't have that problem in the new building. But I'd anticipate it would last for as many decades as possible.
So you're talking about this spending, but will you, as you said, there's some housing in it. Presumably you can sell off some of the land that the council owns, car parks or other areas, and will that not pay for at least part of the building costs?
Yeah, so we have to build the new Angel Centre first. That's the first thing to say. And then we would recoup any money later on in the process as part of our wider master plan of the area. So we have to essentially fund the capital expenditure first. Now, in terms of some of the residential development, we're also asking questions about hotel, a new health centre too, and other potential options for commercial units. There's two things we can do. You can either sell a lot, in which case you get your capital receipt straight away, or what you can do is you could look to essentially keep hold of those yourself and get a continued income over time.
So that would pay off the interest.
Exactly. Now, which one of those we go down, we're completely open-minded at the moment about it, to be honest. I think a lot will depend on market conditions at the time, but also the construction of the new Angel Centre is critical, because that opens up where the Angel Centre is at the moment, and that area by the river that actually has got some of the probably the highest value land on it too. So we really need to essentially just take take stock at a point in time, which would be once the new Angel Centre is built, in terms of what's the most financially sustainable outcome then. But you've got to get the new Angel Centre built first, and that's why we're starting with that.
Let's talk about how the council is encouraging business in centre of Tunbridge, as we know, in the centre of Tunbridge, we know that all high streets are struggling, high rates, competition from online sales. You put car parking fees up. presumably you have to recoup some of your costs, you have to balance the books, but things like that, and also fees for events. So the Riverwalk, Tunbridge Riverwalk Music, it's a very successful event, but it does have to pay fees to the council in order to put events on. Those events are bringing people into Tunbridge and benefiting other businesses. Why do you pay fees? First of all, Wes, why does Riverwalk have to pay fees?
So any event, whether it's Riverwalk Music or any other event, does have to pay a small fee to the council. That covers a number of things. So, for example, if it's on council-owned land, then obviously council's got to insure that land in terms of any damages. In some instances, not Riverwalk, but certainly some of the events that we have at Tunbridge Castle too, there's a use of the council's facilities. So we've had big Christmas events at Tunbridge Castle in the last few years, and we've seen the impact of that on the grass. So one of the reasons why we charge events operators a fee is to essentially get the facilities back to how they should be after the event has finished. Now, there are different fees for different events, and I'm not going to sort of go through them all now, and we're speaking to all the event organisers individually about it. But essentially, the bigger the event you've got, the higher the fee you pay. And in addition to that, there are licensing restrictions too. So there are licensing fees that are needed.
So what does that mean, licensing?
So essentially, if you've got an event of any sort, you need to ensure you have a temporary event notice, particularly if it's for 499 or fewer people. You've got to get that from the council. That doesn't cost very much, just £20-odd, really. But it's still a fee that has to be paid. And then obviously for bigger events, there's policing costs that come on top of that too. And the police and the council's events teams work very closely together to ensure the event safety. So obviously, take Riverwalk Music, for example. There's alcohol that's being sold in the area, and it's right next to a river. So there is a safety concern there. So obviously the police monitor that, as well as the council's events and licensing teams too. And obviously that costs money for the council to do.
And you say that Riverwalk are paying more now because their event is sort of spread across the river. It's been more successful.
Yes.
But presumably the problem for them is they don't actually get any money per person. They don't charge an entrance fee. So do you charge less for events which are free for the community?
So that's a decision that the organisers of Riverwalk Music have made not to charge. That's their choice. From the council's perspective, we're not going to tell operators whether they should or shouldn't charge for their event. How they pay ours is a matter for them, ultimately. I don't want to be the annoying council that's obstructive in any way, but at the same time want to be realistic as to some of the costs that the council incurs, and also some of the risks too when it's on council-owned land. Essentially, you are the landowner, an event is taking place, it's got lots of people there, and if anything goes wrong, the council is liable for it. So I always make that point because I just think it's important to remember that that essentially is how it's operating. We do, and we have supported financially a lot of events over the years, and we continue to do so separately through grant schemes and through advertising and lots of other ways too. We run the artisan market in Tunbridge Castle, so we're very committed to the events in Tunbridge. It's one of the things that makes the town great. But at the same time, we don't want to shy away. I think it'd be dishonest if we did, of saying actually these come without risk or without cost for the council.
And what about the car parking fees then? Because they did go up a while ago, and people were worried that more shops would close as a result.
Yeah, and we've noticed that there hasn't been a huge change in terms of the number of vehicles.
Because Sunday was changed a lot, didn't it?
Sunday was free. Sunday is now chargeable. It was a difficult decision at the time. It wasn't one that you wanted to take, but at the same time, you have to deal with the financial burden that the council's got. Certainly at the time, inflation was running much higher than council tax increases were legally allowed to be raised, so we have to make more money from fees and charges. We had to deal with some of the parking problems that free parking causes too. And also we needed to look at different ways in which we can support the town. So that means bringing in more income in order to spend more money on the town itself. But as I say, we haven't noticed a significant difference in terms of occupancy of the car parks. That's really good. I know it's been a difficult time for businesses over the last year or so. And from speaking to them, I know there's been some very particular challenges on Tunbridge High Streets around business rates and obviously rent increases, which are the two biggest costs that businesses face. Unfortunately, the council doesn't control the rents that you pay your landlord, and neither does it control the business rates that are set by the valuation office. So all of our impact is quite peripheral around the sides, and those two big kind of costs and big burdens on businesses have been increasing significantly, both in Tunbridge and elsewhere. So we're conscious, we're always trying to help businesses. Again, we do lots of different initiatives to encourage that. But at the same time, the council effectively is a business itself. I mean, we can't go bankrupt. We have to set a balanced budget, and we've always got to be mindful of utilising our assets for that.
So Matt, we've talked quite a lot about what's going on in Tunbridge, which is great. But while you're here, you are a Conservative, and you one of the few councils left that are Conservative. Why do you think the Conservative Party is doing so badly at the moment? Reform are well ahead, Labour are second, the Conservatives are languishing in third. Is it a hopeless position for the Conservatives?
I think the question for the Conservatives is a similar question for Labour, all the Liberal Democrats or Greens, all the established parties, really, which is why Reform so far ahead in the polls at the moment. Look, I think people are cross. They're cross at lots of things, and they're cross for lots of reasons. I think the Conservative Party is very much in the firing line nationally because we didn't cover ourselves in glory between 2019 and 2024 when we were in government, and the behaviour of some of our MPs at the time. And I wouldn't exclude a lot of our local MPs, who I thought acted quite honourably, whether they're still sitting MPs or not. But a lot of our MPs in Parliament at the time let the side down, frankly. And that's very disappointing.
But you're saying it's about personalities. Isn't the main issue that people feel poorer, and at the moment they're blaming the fact that there's been very high immigration into the country for the fact that they feel poorer?
Yeah, and I think there's an issue about the economy and where the economy is going, and actually the fact that economic growth has not been where the government has said it's going to be, given that's one of its primary missions over the last year. There is a huge issue with migration. That's absolutely clear.
So has the Conservative Party sorted its policy out? Because Reform seemed pretty clear what they're going to try to do, and the Conservatives weren't that clear in government, and they don't seem to be that clear in opposition either.
Well, we've come out and said we've got the deportation bill, which we would like the government to implement immediately. That would essentially ensure that all illegal immigrants are not able to remain in the country and they are deported.
Does that include asylum seekers?
Yeah, that would include many asylum seekers too. And I think that's very important, because part of the problem that we've got at the moment, with the numbers that are coming over, is that we're not able, our infrastructure isn't there in order to give them their needs. We know we've got a massive housing problem for people from Tunbridge and Morlin at the moment. So I see that every day through the council. But that's why the Conservative Party's come out with a very clear policy in this regard, and the Labour government have decided, for whatever reason, not to implement it. I was disappointed today that the government is going to essentially challenge the legal ruling that allowed Epping Forest District Council to close the Bell Hotel in Epping when it was being used for housing for migrants.
But how do you solve the problem? That they're here, the lawyers would challenge any efforts by government to deport them, so you know, they have to go somewhere, don't
well,
they?
Well, you use the deportation bill to do that, and at the end of the day,
and there's no other court that they can appeal to, like the European courts?
No, and I think ultimately the position in terms of the European Court of Human Rights is incredibly risky for all parties at the moment. We absolutely need to keep withdrawing that off the table if the European Court of Human Rights isn't going to allow us to proceed with a deportation bill.
So you would leave it?
I would definitely keep that on the table, absolutely. And I think, frankly, because there's no evidence to my mind that the European Court of Human Rights is taking that seriously, then yes, we should definitely look towards leaving. But it's not my decision to make. I'm not a member of the party that's in government. I'm not a member of the government. I'm just the local council leader trying to do my best. But I can tell you that if the Home Office comes to us and says, look, we would like to use lots of accommodation that you've got in Tunbridge and Morlin for this purpose, we want to use hotels, we want to use HMOs, we would fight that very hard, because ultimately we've got a housing waiting list of our own and we want to prioritise local homes to local people, and that's got to be at the forefront.
Matt, I'm sure we could talk for many more minutes.
I'm sure we could, Martin.
Not hours, but you've been very generous with your time this afternoon, and it's been fascinating talking to you.
It's been great to be here, Martin. Thanks for having me.
And it'd be great to have you back again.
Anytime.
Fantastic. That's Matt Borton, the leader of Tunbridge and Morling Borough Council, talking to me, Martin Webber, on Friday Drive Time.